All right. Thank you, everybody, for the great questions on X or Twitter. Here are my responses to these questions I asked on the 13th of August, 2026. First, Space Tiger asks, I heard you recently say you are working to hopefully create a stateless society in 500 years. Isn't this similar to the idea of religion, a faith in a future which motivates your actions in the now? Why would someone who doesn't believe in a higher power want to involve themselves with something bigger than themselves, which they are likely to never see? Well, that's a great question, and I really, really do appreciate it. Oh my God, you've changed my mind. I'm going to be a hedonist. Just kidding. No, it's a great question, and thank you. Very, very thoughtful, very intelligent. So I will tell you, this may sound cheesy, it may not resonate with you, but I love philosophy. I love, love, love humanity. I love the world and its potential. It moves me really beyond words, beyond tectonic plates, beyond the operations of light, energy, focus, and brilliance in the universe. I am motivated by the absolutely glorious potential of our species to reason and be virtuous and be kind. And I view humanity and myself on occasion, of course, as kind of broken apes, ground down by historical power and prejudice and hatred and tribalism and so on. And these are all aspects of us emerging from the pre-dawn of history and evolution and all these kinds of things. But I absolutely love the potential of humanity. I feel that there's just a number of wires that need to be connected and stay connected. And I love the fact that we've done absolutely everything except truly try philosophy. And this 3,000-year-old discipline of which I am a part, well, we've worked out logic, we've worked out the scientific method, the free market, one of the great boons of mankind, emerged out of the philosophical traditions of the Enlightenment, and we have limited government and property rights, the end of slavery. In these very hidden and tectonic ways, philosophy has been moving behind the scenes. It's almost like chess pieces moved by the wind or the faint tremors of the earth. It's easy to think that in the details of human progress, sorry, I'm just very moved by this, so I hope you don't mind a smidge of emotion. I certainly don't, but I hope you don't either. But the great beauty and power of philosophy has yet to be enacted and accepted, well, I guess first accepted, then enacted by humanity. That is the great hope. That is the great hope. The constant rise and fall and expansion and crash and freedom and slavery and wealth and poverty and all of these horrible, you know, quarter millennia cycles of civilizations and this sort of slow, staggering, bladed, ground upward, struggling path of humanity can be laid bare, made clear, smoothed out, and achieved through philosophy. It is to the eternal credit of philosophy, in a way, that it is the one thing that has yet to be truly tried. The one thing. We've tried superstition, we've tried religion, we've tried political power, we've tried central banking, we've tried government schools, we've tried indoctrination, we've tried astrology, right? We've tried tea leaves. We've tried hedonism, intuition, instinct, greed, machinations. We've tried everything. We've tried everything except the one thing that will actually work. And of course, it is my goal to spread philosophy, you see, not as a theory, but as a practice. It is my job to spread philosophy, not as a theory, but as a practice. If I tell you about the is-ought dichotomy, or I tell you about Aristotle's three laws of logic, or I tell you about Kantian ethics and so on, it's interesting, and it's probably diverting, and it's probably food for thought and interesting conversation and so on. But if I were to say to you, I mean, let's say I had never spoken in the world, and somebody had said to you, live your life philosophically, what would you think? You'd think, I don't know, some kind of Marcus Aurelius, semi-drugged, absentee landlord, distance from the 1,000 natural shocks that flesh is heir to. You'd think of being kind of detached and maybe a little bit amused and so on. Dust in the wind, man. And so you wouldn't know with specificity how to live your life philosophically. It has a sort of vague, grizzled, wise, gray-bearded kind of absence and aloofness from the things of the world. But philosophy is a deep ninja. Philosophy is supposed to be down there in the world, throwing error aside and gathering truth and virtue to the heart of all of us. It is supposed to be in the world, not on the mountaintop. It's supposed to be a personal trainer, not an abstract guru. It is supposed to tell you to immerse yourself into the things of this world rather than absent yourself from the hurly-burly of conflict and virtue. So, why would I do this? Why would I lash myself to the mast of being able to hear the siren song of the world that can be, and then, in a sense, torture myself trying to bring the truth and reason and virtue and values to the world? That is, though it hates these things in many ways. People have a love-hate relationship with philosophy. They love it in the theory. They hate it in the practice. You know, much like dieting, exercise. A lot of people like it in the theory. Don't like it so much in the practice. I mean, I had a pretty good life. I mean, I would say I have a pretty good life prior to philosophy. Like, philosophy's made it bad. I wouldn't argue that. But I've had a pretty good life. Prior to philosophy, I was married. I had a great career. I had a big social circle and did sports and traveled. And, you know, I got to travel all over the world, staying in first-class hotels, traveling first-class, doing work in the software field. I got to go to Hawaii. I was just telling a friend of mine about this the other day. Back when Access 2000 was released, I went to Hawaii for a Microsoft conference and stayed in the Hilton Waikoloa, which has an amazing snorkel lake full of all the most amazing sea creatures. And I woke up in the morning. I remember, I think I watched Vanilla Sky, the TV, passed out before it ended because it's kind of a sleepy movie. And I woke up in the morning in Hawaii and I strode over to the curtains and I opened the curtains. And there in the azure Cameron Diaz eye depths of the Pacific, there were whales passing by my view. And I took a deep breath and I thought, man, this is great. And then I went and I did some stuff at the conference and I spoke to people and we got sort of recognition from Microsoft as the first people to ship a Microsoft 2000 system. And it was, you know, this is a great life. It's a great life. I remember I went to Morocco for Y2K with one of my oldest friends and we had a great time. And then I spent a night in Toronto and I flew off to China for business. And I remember I was supposed to fly with one of our business partners who was going to introduce me everywhere. They couldn't make it. So I basically just flew to China, not knowing what the heck was going on or what I was going to do. And I landed and I sort of managed to, this is before there was sort of easy communication, no texting or anything like that. And I figured out which hotel I was supposed to go to. I went to the hotel. I'd slept a bit on the plane, so I wasn't tired. And I walked down to Tiananmen Square. It was freezing cold. I remember that. And I kept having to dart into hotel lobbies to warm up. And I stood in Tiananmen Square and I just thought about the incredibly brave souls who had protested what they protested and taken the dangers that they had taken. And I met wonderful Chinese people, very warm, very friendly, very nice. And we did great business together. And I remember negotiating a business contract while my feet were getting massaged under the table. It was a very wild experience. And they're still stuck in the Mad Men 3-martini lunch business sense in China back then. And I remember going down to the market and haggling with people to buy things. We didn't speak each other's language, but we used calculators, and they would punch in the numbers that they wanted to sell for, and I would punch in the numbers I wanted to buy for. And I loved the spirit of commerce. I loved the spirit of enthusiasm. And I remember going out to a very remote research and development facility where the washrooms were just troughs in the ground. I don't know if it's a concentration camp or something. And I remember these very funny Chinese businessmen that I was working with. I demanded that I play them ping pong for money. And I said, big nose foreign person does not want to play. And it was great, a great deal of fun. And, you know, my life was pretty fun. It was pretty great. It was pretty great. And, but, you know, I have thought, and sorry, I know this is a long way to answer that this, but I, you know, had started as I cleaned offices and I put the New York Times together in bookstores from the age of 11 onwards. Later on, of course, the New York Times tried to take me apart. But I started off from less than nothing, really, and then rose to good prominence, and I spoke at conferences, and I did all sorts of wonderful things in the business world. That's a pretty great life. And I thought, you know, it's a pretty good reward for not the most auspicious beginning in life, and I was happy about it, and I was pleased with it. And, you know, I worked hard to get my employees' raises. I raised payroll about $1 million a year to by presenting to the board how people were underpaid and all of that. So, you know, I did some good, helped people with their careers, mentored a lot of people, taught them how to write code and do sales and marketing and things like that, if that's what they were interested in. And, you know, we opened up an office out in Vancouver. We flew out to Vancouver and had wonderful meals in giant restaurants overlooking the ocean. And then I flew down to San Francisco and met with salespeople to instruct them on the latest version of the software. And we all went out for dinner on these beautiful restaurants overlooking the bay. I mean, honestly, it was the U.S. grant. I think it was, I remember staying in a hotel for $400 a night, because I remember the board said to me, you know, you're dealing with the big boys here. You know, we're dealing with Fortune 100 companies, Fortune 200 companies. You got to go and look good. So rent a nice car, and, you know, you don't want them picking you up from the Super 8 motel. So, and I remember, like, gosh, the sheets were so clean and everything was so nice and the food was so great. And it was like, that was, I don't know, Islamic paradise. It was like, it was great. It was great. I remember, sorry, I'll stop in a sec. I just remember a Sunday morning, I woke up and it was bitterly cold in Toronto. I lived downtown. And I went out for a little walk, and I was like huddled and, you know, the kind of cold that gets you into your teeth and lets you know if anything's wrong. And then I came back and I had to make myself a nice omelet for lunch. And then I got a phone call, and it was the CEO saying, hey, you gotta jet down to Phoenix. We have a sudden opening and we'll be able to present the software in the morning. So suit up and boot up. And I did that, and I got a flight, and I jumped down to the airport, and this was before 9/11, and so it's pretty easy to fly. And I just remember checking into the hotel. It was probably about 7 or 8 o'clock at night by the time I got there, and I didn't have anything to do until the next morning. So I went for a nice long workout. I went for a nice long swim. I sat in the hot tub, and I remember being in the pool, swimming on my back with my goggles, looking up at the water, and above the water were the shaky stars and the wobbly moon and all of that through the eddies and whirls of the water. And I remember thinking, my God, I woke up this morning colder than a witch's tit. And here I am in a beautiful hotel swimming at night and getting paid for it and all that kind of stuff. So it was a pretty great life. It was a pretty great life. I remember going to do a presentation in New York, and I did the presentation. And then that night I went to go and see the Bare Naked Ladies. That's a Canadian band who were playing in New York, and they were a very funny and warm band and all of that, a band with banter. Anyway, so I don't mean to brag or anything like that, because, you know, I worked hard to get there, but it was a pretty great life. And then this sort of creeping sense, these sort of silken, icy tendrils of responsibility just sort of began creeping along my spine when I realized that I did have a rather unique and powerful gift for talking about ideas and reason and virtue and values. And, you know, it's like when you feel a kind of heavy burden landing upon you, potentially. I mean, one of the things that I sort of think about is, can anyone else do that? Really? Is there anyone else? Come on. I can't be the only one. And when that burden kind of creeps up on you, then you want to shrug it off. Because I was like, oh man, that's going to be a lot of conflict and combat. And conflict and combat, so to speak, in the business world is fun and energetic. Like the companies that would compete with me for contracts and business and so on, you know, we were kind of like sports teams. Like we razzed each other and so on. And they won some. I think I won a few more. But I was like, okay, so the conflict in the business world is really not too bad. It's all sort of limited and it's not personal and so on. But, you know, if you start to go into philosophy, man, it's really thumbing your nose at the powers that be and deflating the egos of vain people and proving people wrong who are heavily invested in being right. And, you know, it gets ugly. Man, you think politics is ugly. Philosophy is just about the ugliest business there is. Because at least people understand that politics is ugly. So when the sort of tendrils of responsibility, I hope you find this interesting. I mean, yeah, I hope you do. But when the tendrils of responsibility sort of spread through my soul, then I was like, I don't want to, but I don't really want to. Because I knew to some degree where it would lead. It's not like I haven't studied quite a bit the history of philosophers, not just the history of philosophy, but, you know, the fate of philosophers. And I was like, I don't really want to, you know, I've just sort of come into my own over the last sort of 10 years and I've got a pretty great life and I don't really want to get into this ugly, vicious, soul-draining blood sport of fencing with ideas in an arena with people who have no honor. Not you, the dear listener, of course, but sophists and manipulators and gaslighters and so on. So I don't want to do it. I didn't want to do it in a way. And oh, gosh, you know, that it's kind of a cheesy thing maybe, but you know, that light sort of comes down. Oh, here's the light that comes down from the heavens, illuminates one person. It was like, oh, come on, man. Don't make it be me. I don't want to do that. I mean, sort of two things sort of stuck in my mind about that. And you understand, this isn't about me. You know, what do you particularly care about my machinations of mind from a quarter century ago? But it's really about, I think, you and your potential and what you can have to offer in the world. And sorry, with all of the theory here, I also have to practically charge up my phone for the show tonight in 44 minutes. So I was like, okay, so I thought, I don't know how many people throughout history have realized they have a particular ability, let's say in philosophy, and have veered off into other paths, right? Into other goals, into other ideas, other arguments, other approaches. How many people have looked at that live wire and said, nope, I'm not gonna do it. I can't remember, was it John Stuart Mill or some aged philosopher who had writings on atheism? I read about him in my graduate degree. He had writings on atheism, and there was a particular kind of, I don't know, like anti-skeptic or anti-agnostic or anti-atheist movement underway, I think it was in England, and he took all of his older writings, and he was in his 80s, and he buried them, and he burned them, and he got rid of them, and I'm like, wow, imagine being able to do that. But how many people have stood on this precipice and said, I don't want to? Well, of course, I was standing on the precipice, and I thought, okay, so there's a lot of people probably who've had this opportunity and this ability and have not put the two together. And, you know, for reasons, by the by, that I really, really sympathize with. I mean, it's one thing I've got the internet so I can walk and talk and publish it to thousands or tens of thousands or millions of people over time. It's a little bit different than trying to get your book past the royal censor and so on, right? So, how many people looked at that and stepped back and looked away and said, you know, someone else is going to do it. Like, who will bell the cat? Did you ever hear that story? You know, like the mice are all like, you know, if we put a bell around the neck of the cat, man, we'll be able to hear that cat coming and, you know, we'll be a whole lot safer than we are now. Like, that would be fantastic. Wouldn't that be great? And everyone, you know, kind of agrees, right? But nobody actually wants to go up and bail the cat because it's kind of dangerous. It's like, well, if we had rational philosophy as the basis for ethics, we could bring humanity together in a common mindset in the same way that, you know, science and mathematics and price does. Price brings people together to buy and sell. So I thought of the number of people who'd step back with, again, completely understandable reasons. And I thought, you know, this new technology. And I just, because I was a rampant technologist and a cutting edge technologist, I wrote about podcasting in the 90s, by the by. Was it 90s? No, let me be fair. Early 2000s, like half a decade before YouTube. So I wrote about a guy using a computer and a camera to speak to the world at least half a decade before I started publishing. So as a technologist, it was pretty clear to me, and you could almost argue that being the technologist was a good preparation for this kind of stuff. So, sorry, I don't mean to be distracted. I'm just thinking of making a little coffee, but I don't want the sound of the coffee maker to mess up the audio. So let me try doing that and not be distracted. Let me make a decision one way or the other. There we go. All right. So I thought all the people who stood on the edge and then turned away, and you know, beneath the, if all the things that have to be, we often have to cry, but beneath the weight of gravity, we stumble and we fly. And it's an old Paul Young song. Like, what if you just take the leap and see if you can fly? So that was number one. And number two was, I thought, in the history of philosophy, nobody has done parenting and nobody has done an ironclad, airtight, rational proof of secular ethics. And these were the two things that I most wanted to bring to the world, right? The philosophy applied to parenting and a rational proof of secular ethics that could not be evaded or escaped. And that's what I most wanted to do. And a lot of the parenting stuff, you know, came out of conversations with my wife. For those of you who don't know, my wife practiced psychology as a mental health professional for almost 30 years, really. So she was, you know, in conversations with her, I'd have all of this philosophical stuff and, you know, she'd give me this smile of sympathy and understanding. And she'd say, yes, but it all begins with the family. It all starts with the family. And that kind of, you know, very much wrenched my position to that way of thinking. And so I began looking at the roots of the family and applying philosophical principles to parenting and child raising and spanking and the non-aggression principle, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, philosophy's had 3,000 years and it's never taken root and it's never taken hold and it's never really moved the population in the direction of reason. What philosophy has done is it's been just enough to tear down the churches. It has not been enough to raise better structures. And I wrote about this in one of my books. I think it was called Against the Gods. Philosophy has torn down the foundations of religion and collapsed the church, but it has not given people anything alternative and better to live for and to believe in. So I thought philosophy, and by that I mean sort of atheistic, materialistic philosophy, has torn down religion, which basically means it's torn down the conscience and the void of personal conscience and ethics has been filled by political power, which is, of course, very bad, right? That's not good at all. So I thought, if philosophy is doing more damage than good, and there's no way to turn back the clock, so to speak, or turn back the tide, then I'm going to have to find a way. Oh, how interesting. There's a pigeon here. That is very unusual. I almost never see pigeons up here. Anyway, so it is something that philosophy had done a lot of dirty work. And it's like if you're a surgeon and some evil surgeon has just hacked someone up, then you kind of need to stitch them back up or they're going to die, right? If that makes sense. And I saw that a lot of philosophy had taken down religion, which was the foundation of ethics, particularly Christianity in the West, and had not given us ethics. So it had taken away ethics from religion rather than provide us ethics in a secular fashion. So that is bad. So some thoughtless, perhaps amoral philosophers had torn down ethics, and I knew a way to rebuild them, and I felt responsibility as a member of this profession, so to speak, to stitch up the wounds made by other philosophers who delighted more in taking down the impossible than proving ethics. So yes, basing ethics on religion is not rational. So fine, get rid of religion, you get rid of ethics, then you damn well owe society some secular ethics. But of course, so many philosophers are paid by the state that they can't do secular ethics in the way that I do, because I am a volunteer donation-based life form, freedomain.com/donate. If you'd be so kind as to help out the show, I would deeply and humbly appreciate it. Thank you so much. So, philosophy for 3,000 years, and, you know, obviously more than 3,000 years, you can find religious iconography, which is a form of philosophy in a way, going back tens of thousands of years, I think 40,000 years or something like that. And so the religious iconography and statues and so on going back tens of thousands of years. But let's just say, you know, sort of formal written understood philosophy, 3,000 years plus, and we still don't have an answer. We still don't have an answer as to how to reliably make the world better and how to prove secular ethics. And I knew I could do it. I knew I could do it because the one thing I will tell you about myself is I have fairly ferocious willpower, like a pit bull. Like, I get my teeth into something, I will not let it go until it's done. And I think, like, really a lot of the stuff that I've had to offer hasn't even been any particular brilliance. I mean, I think some of it has, but it's just, I will not stop until I get it done. This served me very well in the business world when I was given the most insane challenges with regards to technology. I was like, I will find a way and I will not stop until I get it done. And that was my life. And I just willing my way. The world is a war of wills, basically. So I knew I could do it because I just knew I could will it. I also knew that I was intelligent enough to get it done. And I also knew that it was going to be simpler than we thought. I knew it had to be something you had to explain. Like, ethics had to be something you could explain to a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old. And so I didn't want to do it, but I thought, well, it's been 3,000 years. And this is where willpower comes from. Willpower just comes from perspective, right? And I said to myself, well, it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years going back to the untold prehistory of thought that is characterized by either writing that we've lost or people who had dorm-style jawbone conversations that didn't last the test of time. But it's been thousands and countless thousands of years that people have been talking about truth and virtue and right and wrong, you know, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics, the big three, and it's been 3,000 years, and we don't have an answer. And that also kind of pissed me off, to be honest with you. Like, how can I be infatuated with a discipline that has no answers after 3,000 years? No answers that everyone agrees on. No, I mean, you go to mathematics. There's tons of stuff that the opposite angle theorem, the triangle inequality relation, 2 and 2 make 4, right? There's no such thing as negative square roots, right? So, a negative times a negative is a positive, right? A negative times a positive is a negative. Like, there's things that mathematicians all agree on. What are the things that philosophers all agree on after 3,000 years? I would argue we had philosophy. In other words, people wondered why the world was and what the stars were before we had math. I think philosophy is older. We've got tens of thousands of years, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years or more of philosophy. And we got nothing. We've got nothing of certainty. And that kind of, honestly, I'd be straight up with you, man. It just kind of pissed me off. Like, how is it possible that the discipline I love the most and that I think is the one untried discipline for the perpetual improvement of mankind. How can it be after tens of thousands of years, there's nothing that is known for certain? I mean, Christians will all agree on the divinity of Christ, but you can't get philosophers to agree on anything except perhaps that government provided licensure and tenure are kind of cool. I felt ashamed of the discipline. I can't really say it was my profession. I mean, I was a businessman, right? I was an actor, a writer, playwright, director, businessman, not philosopher. I mean, certainly my graduate school thesis was deep in the guts and heart of philosophy, for sure. But it was not my profession. It's what I loved the most. It's what I would have most loved to do. But I also saw, of course, that philosophy was being marred by horrible injustice, particularly against white males. You could see the DEI stuff coming from a mile away, and it's just wretched and terrible and horrible and unjust and so on, right? So I was ashamed of philosophy, and I thought, it's been thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of years, and it hasn't been done. It hasn't been proven. Even those who despise my arguments the most cannot overturn UPB or the spanking debate or peaceful parenting or things like that. That's just the reality. So I thought, if it's not me, who's it going to be? It's been tens of thousands of years. It hasn't been done. If it's not me, who's it going to be? Now, listen, I understand, and I completely and totally sympathize. You know, there's a line, I think it's in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where somebody says, did it ever occur to you that Jesus might have been the bad guy? And somebody else says, Stephen Dedalus, I think the hero, says, well, the first person that occurred to was Jesus himself, right? So I completely understand the skin-crawlingly cringe. Listen, I'm British. I know. The skin-crawlingly cringe factor of, I'm going to say philosophy and I'm going to turn this discipline around. I get all of that. And if it's any consolation, if you thinking of it and cringing about it, trust me, it's been for decades that I've been thinking about it and cringing about it. But I'm an empiricist. And as an empiricist, it only matters what I can do, not what I think about it. Does that make sense? It only matters what I can do, not what I think about it. So, you know, Freddie Mercury, the singer, Farouk Bulsara from Zanzibar, when he was very young, he was like, I'm going to be a star. And people would take photographs of him and he would only let them keep the ones that made him look the best. And he's like, I'm going to be a superstar. I'm this, that, and the other, right? Now, of course, he could sing gloriously. He could compose complex music. I mean, March of the Black Queen of Queen II is an astounding piece of music. And he also was a great performer. And his piano was like a metronome. It was so stable. And he had such incredible musical gifts, obviously perfect pitch, but also even when he was a student in India, he went to a boarding school in India, he could hear a song on the radio and then basically just play it back. And I mean, that's a remarkable ability. So, you know, he had it all. He had good looks. He had stage presence. He had a fantastic singing voice. He played piano beautifully. He composed music. So if you say, well, geez, what are the odds that some scrawny kid with buck teeth from Zanzibar is going to become a world rock star, you'd say, well, the odds are tiny. Of course, right? We understand that. But an empiricist says, can you do it? Not what's the evidence or proof that you have done it. And that's belief in yourself. Belief in yourself should be reasonable, right? I believe that I can be a great philosopher. I don't believe that I can be a great singer. I don't believe that I could be a great composer or pianist or guitarist, or I could not be a great ballet dancer, or even in my youth, because I have the flexibility of your average slab of sidewalk. But I would say that it doesn't matter what I think about what I can do. It only matters whether I can do it. And of course, the basic reality is, this is an old statement, I think it's from Henry Ford, if you think you can, or you think you can't, you're right. Now, I don't really agree with the affirmative in that. You know, I wasn't going to be a hair model, or I wasn't going to be a basketball star because I'm just a shade under 6 feet and I'm bald-ish, right? So, you know, if you think you can't, you're right. That's for sure. If you think you can't, you're right. If you think you can, then you build the evidence that you could. Right? So, obviously, Freddie Mercury sang, and, you know, I remember even when he was a student, people were like, wow, that's a voice that's going places. I remember somebody said that about him. And so, sorry, I know it's kind of goofy to talk about Freddie Mercury, but it doesn't matter what I think about what I can do. It only matters whether I can do it. Right? And I knew I could do it. I knew I would have to take a couple of runs at it. I knew it would need some refinement, but I knew I could do it. And this is why at the beginning of UPB, I say, like, I get the improbability that basically some tech entrepreneur has solved the eternal problem of secular ethics. I get all of that, for sure. And I sympathize with that. I think I understand it. And so I've addressed that, like, it's improbable, and I get your skepticism. But I was like, okay, so it's been 3,000 years. I know I can do it. I also know the other thing. Sorry, I said there were two things, the three things. The third thing is that I knew that the free speech that was coming would not last forever. There's a shock with the powers that be, because they tend to be older. They tend not to understand the new technology. There's kind of a shock when new stuff comes along. And this is, so I've mentioned this before on the show. My mother, when we bought, we used to give my mother quite a lot of money, but she just turned around and gave it to shady lawyers, in my view, to pursue meritless law cases against doctors who I don't think were responsible for her problems. So I had to stop doing that. It was very sad. I really, really wanted to help her. But I do remember my mother calling the CD player that I bought her a gramophone, right? She just couldn't quite adjust to the new technology. So I knew with the internet, there was a chance to publish direct to the population with no filters and no gatekeepers, and that there would be a certain amount of time with which to get these ideas out before the hammer came down. That you or I or anyone would have a span of time, and it probably would be not more than one large election cycle if, you know, people get involved in politics. So there would be a certain span of time with which true communication could occur. And it was 2006 to 2016 were the high points of free speech in the world. I mean, until we have a free society, there'll never be anything again like it. And I'm enormously pleased and proud that I took that opportunity for those 10 years to speak as much truth as the world could stand and back down from nothing that I knew to be true and promote things that I knew that were but true and moral and essential. So it was a short window. I didn't see anybody else stepping up. I'm not sure if people didn't have the ability or didn't have the confidence or if they have that yap, 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 you know, that yammer voice in your head. You know, the yammer voice, which is like, oh, who are you to do it? Don't be ridiculous. Don't be crazy. Who do you think you are? John Locke? Who do you think you are? Aristotle? That's ridiculous. Don't be, right? All that sort of stuff, right? Just the small self, right? The Lilliputians who tie down the giant with the endless dental floss of insecurities. And you just have to, like, say, hey, man, I appreciate the caution, but I'm going to try it anyway. So I felt very much a responsibility to rescue philosophy from irrelevance. But I knew, of course, that rescuing philosophy from irrelevance would bring down the ire of the powers that be. How could it not be the case? How could it, in fact, be otherwise? I mean, it's not an accident that philosophy hasn't gone anywhere. Like, it kind of, it's crashing by design, as the old Pete Townsend song goes. So, if not me, who? If not now, when? I can look back through the caverns of time, to infinity, to prehistory, to the fog that predates literacy, and the solution hasn't been made, hasn't been achieved. Parenting, universal ethics. And the two are two sides of the same coin. If people are heavily traumatized, they can't reason. But until we apply reasoning to parenting, we can't raise children who aren't heavily traumatized, usually in one way or another. So I kind of had to. And it was with excitement, enthusiasm, sorrow, and, you know, some small nervousness, certainly from time to time, that I took on the task. Now, if I'm religious, of course, I would say God was moving through me and it was time for society and the planets aligned and I had to go for it and so on. But obviously, that's not my perspective. So why do it? Why do it? I mean, there's lots of, you know, I benefit from the freedoms that thinkers have generated before me. And like, there's lots of things I could talk about. But really, it comes down to love and hate. It comes down to love and hate. I love the potential of humanity, and I don't love, see, how nice can I put this? Let's see. How nice can I put this? I love the potential of humanity. I hate the brutal, violent power that shreds the conscience and capabilities and courage of humanity. I do not love the manifestation of humanity, but I love the potential of humanity. And I want a world, I've thought about this from time to time, I want a world, I mean, wouldn't it be nice where you didn't have to wake up in the morning and, you know, scan whatever news source you have and say, I wonder what crazy, terrible, horrible, awful, wretched things has been done by the government or the Trade Commission or, you know, whatever it is, right? Some new stupid law, some new stupid injunction, some new stupid tariff. Wouldn't it be nice to free up so much and so many of humanity from a constant fever scan of the latest disasters coming in from the world of politics and the world of coercion and the world of subjugation and the world of subversion? Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to not have to scan your children's homework to look for signs of incipient communism or anti-rationalism and so on? Yeah. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To be wished. So, I kind of had to. I kind of had to, because once you know you can, and you know that you should, and you're grateful for others who did it before, can you really say no? I mean, of course, yeah, it's free will. I mean, it's not like it was a train track that I was lashed to. But I could not avoid the most necessary task without, I think, a kind of bottomless shame and regret. And it's funny because in a way, going back into the conflict of society has returned me to some degree to my childhood. But there was no option, because let's say that I withdrew from a task that was essential and it, by all appearances, only I could do it. I mean, if there was somebody else who was doing the philosophy of childhood and, you know, peaceful parenting and UPB and so on, I'd have been like, whew, thank goodness, I'll go back to traveling and playing Scrabble with my wife and, you know, just lovely, you know, parenting, lovely things like that. But there was nobody else who was doing it. And there wasn't even anyone else who was saying, this desperately needs to be done. I can't figure it out, though. Like, it was just a complete absence. And so when I was a wee bairn, when I was a child, I could not speak truth to power because the teachers, the priests, my mother, my father, I guess even my elder brother to some degree, they punched back hard if I spoke truth. And if I had said, no, I'm not going to solve the major problems of philosophy and implement reason and evidence in parenting in a practical sense in the world, I'm not going to do it, then it would have been because I was scared of the blowback, I was scared of the attacks. I'm sorry, I don't need more than one word, because I think blowback kind of sums it up. And then I would have joined all the people who turned away from truly practical and rational ethics to pursue other things. And then, I don't know, do they just lie to themselves and say, well, it couldn't have happened. Oh, well, it doesn't matter, or it could never have been done, or whatever it is, right? But of course, if philosophy cannot come up with secular ethics, then philosophy has no purpose. The purpose of philosophy is ethics. And it's not religious ethics, otherwise it would be theology. So the purpose of philosophy is rational, objective ethics. And if philosophy cannot come up with rational, objective ethics, then just shut down the discipline. But I love the discipline. I love philosophy. And therefore, it had to be rescued. You know, if your beloved child is getting caught in waves and being pulled under, you charge into the ocean and brave whatever rocks and kelp and stingrays to get your child and pull them to safety. So philosophy was drowning, was going under, was being replaced by its, you know, hideous evil twin of ideology, which is just submission of the human mind to bullying under the guise of truth and virtue. It's a humiliation ritual, not the pursuit of truth. And I couldn't stand. I couldn't stand to spend the rest of my life from, like, gosh, I mean, I'm 59, so, you know, 21 years ago, I was 38, so I couldn't stand from, let's say, 38 to 88. That's 50 years, right? And I couldn't stand to spend a half century back in my childhood being unable to speak the truth because there are mean people around. I would have spent 50 years. I would have been out of my childhood for a relatively short period of time because it wasn't like I was 18 and it was fine. So I would have been out of my childhood for a relatively short period of time, and then I would have been swept right back into my childhood where I would have avoided telling the truth out of fear. And I just, that would be a terrible life, a shameful life, really, a shameful life. And ambition is a flame that you light and spread, or it hisses and dies. I could say, well, you know, I'll do another 10 years of business and travel and fun and conferences and then, yeah, right. But no, it doesn't work that way. At least not for me. You strike while the iron is hot. Do it later is do it never. So I hope that makes sense. I hope that's of interest to you. And of course, I hope that helps you understand perhaps how valuable and helpful it can be to stop judging yourself and simply do what you know is possible and build the evidence that you can. And once you know that you can, just make it happen. freedomain.com/donate. I love you guys so much. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.